This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Difference Engine by William Gibson and Bruce Sterling, performed by Simon Vance. First Iteration: The Angel of Goliad. Composite image, optically encoded by escort craft of the trans-channel airship Lord Brunel. Aerial view of suburban Cherbourg. October 14th, 1905. A villa. A garden. A balcony. Erase the balcony's wrought iron curves, exposing a bath chair and its occupant. Reflected sunset glints from the nickel plate of the chair's wheel spokes. The occupant, owner of the villa, rests her arthritic hands upon fabric woven by a jacquard loom. These hands consist of tendons, tissue, jointed bone. Through quiet processes of time and information, threads within the human cells have woven themselves into a woman. Her name is Sybil Gerard. Below her, in a neglected formal garden, leafless vines lace wooden trellises on whitewashed, flaking walls. From the open windows of her sick room, a warm draught stirs the loose white hair at her neck, bringing scents of coal smoke, jasmine, opium. Her attention is fixed upon the sky, upon a silhouette of vast and irresistible grace, metal in her lifetime having taught itself to fly. In advance of that magnificence, tiny unmanned aeroplanes dip and skirl against the red horizon. Like starlings, Sybil thinks. The airship's lights, square golden windows, hint at human warmth. Effortlessly, with the incomparable grace of organic function, she imagines a distant music there, the music of London. The passengers promenade. They drink. They flirt. Perhaps they dance. Thoughts come unbidden, the mind weaving its perspectives, assembling meaning from emotion and memory. She recalls her life in London, recalls herself so long ago, making her way along the Strand, pressing past the crush at Temple Bar, pressing on, the city of memory winding itself about her, till, by the walls of Newgate, the shadow of her father's hanging falls. And memory turns, deflected, swift as light, down another byway, one where it is always evening. It is January 15th, 1855. A room in Grand's Hotel, Piccadilly. One chair was propped backward, wedged securely beneath the door's cut glass knob. Another was draped with clothing, a woman's fringed mantlet, a mud-crusted skirt of heavy worsted, a man's checked trousers and cutaway coat. Two forms lay beneath the bedclothes of the laminated maple four-poster, and off in the iron grip of winter, Big Ben bellowed 10 o'clock, great hoarse calliope sounds, the coal-fired breath of London. Sybil slid her feet through icy linens to the warmth of the ceramic bottle in its wrap of flannel. Her toes brushed his shin. The touch seemed to start him from deep deliberation. That was how he was, this dandy Mick Radley. She'd met Mick Radley at Lawrence Dancing Academy down Windmill Street. Now that she knew him, he seemed more the sort for Kellner's in Leicester Square, or even the Portland Rooms. He was always thinking, scheming, muttering over something in his head. Clever, clever. It worried her, and Mrs. Winterhalter wouldn't have approved, for the handling of political gentlemen required delicacy and discretion, qualities Mrs. Winterhalter believed she herself had aplenty, while crediting none to her girls. "No more dolly-mopping, Sybil," Mick said. One of his pronouncements, something about which he'd made up his clever mind. Sybil grinned up at him, her face half hidden by the blanket's warm edge. She knew he liked the grin, her wicked girl grin. "He can't mean that," she thought. "Make a joke of it," she told herself. "But if I weren't a wicked dolly mop, would I be here with you now?"
"No more playing bobtail."
"You know I only go with gentlemen."
Mick sniffed, amused.
"Call me a gentleman, then."
"A very flash gentleman,
Sybil said, flattering him. "One of the fancy. You know I don't care for the rad lords. I spit on 'em, Mick." Sybil shivered, but not unhappily, for she'd run into a good bit of luck here. Full of steak and taters and hot chocolate, in bed between clean sheets in a fashionable hotel. A shiny new hotel, with central steam heat, though she'd gladly have traded the restless gurgling and banging of the scrolled gilt radiator for the glow of a well-banked hearth. And he was a good-looking cove, this Mick Radley, she had to admit. Dressed very flash, had the tin and was generous with it, and he'd yet to demand anything peculiar or beastly. She knew it wouldn't last, as Mick was a touring gent from Manchester and gone soon enough, but there was profit in him, and maybe more when he left her, if she made him feel sorry about it, and generous. Mick reclined into fat feather pillows and slid his manicured fingers behind his spit-curled head. Silk nightshirt, all frothy with lace down the front, only the best for Mick. Now he seemed to want to talk a bit. Men did, usually, after a while. About their wives, mostly. But for Dandy Mick it was always politics. "So you hate the lordships, Sybil?"
"Why shouldn't I?" Sybil said. "I have my reasons."
"I should say you do," Mick said slowly. And the look he gave her then of cool superiority sent a shiver through her.
"What do you mean by that, Mick?"
"I know your reasons for hating the government. I have your number." Surprise seeped into her, then fear. She sat up in bed. There was a taste in her mouth like cold iron. "You keep your card in your bag," he said. "I took that number to a room magistrate I know. He ran it through a government engine for me, and printed up your Bow Street file. Rat-a-tat-tat, like fun." He smirked. "So I know all about you, girl. Know who you are." She tried to put a bold face on it.
"And who's that, then, Mr. Radley?"
"No, Sybil Jones, dearie. You're Sybil Gerard, the daughter of Walter Gerard, the Luddite agitator." He'd raided her hidden past. Machines whirring somewhere, spinning out history. Now Mick watched her face, smiling at what he saw there, and she recognized the look she'd seen before at Lorentz, when first he'd spied her across the crowded floor. A hungry look. Her voice shook.
"How long have you known about me?"
"Since our second night. You know I travel with the General. Like any important man, he has enemies. As his secretary and man of affairs, I take few chances with strangers." Mick put his cruel, deft little hand on her shoulder. "You might have been someone's agent. It was business." Sybil flinched away.
"Spying on a helpless girl," she said at last. "You're a right bastard, you are."
But her foul words scarcely seemed to touch him. He was cold and hard, like a judge or a lordship. "I may spy, girl, but I use the government's machinery for my own sweet purposes. I'm no copper's narc to look down my nose at a revolutionary like Walter Gerard, no matter what the radlords may call him now. Your father was a hero." He shifted on the pillow. "My hero? That was Walter Gerard. I saw him speak on the rights of labour in Manchester. It was a marvel. We all cheered till our throats was raw. The good old Hellcats!" Mick's smooth voice had gone sharp and flat in a Mancunian tang. "Ever hear tell of the Hellcats, Sybil, in the old days?"
"A street gang," Sybil said. "Rough boys in Manchester."
Mick frowned. "We was a brotherhood. A friendship youth guild. Your father knew us well. He was our patron politician, you might say."
"I'd prefer it if you didn't speak of my father, Mr. Radley."
Mick shook his head at her impatiently. "When I heard they'd tried and hanged him," the words like ice behind her ribs, "me and the lads, we took up torches and crowbars and we ran hot and wild. That was Ned Ludd's work, girl, years ago." He picked delicately at the front of his nightshirt. "'Tis not a tale I tell to many. The government's engines have long memories." She understood it now. Mick's generosity and his sweet talk, the strange hints he'd aimed at her of secret plans and better fortune, marked cards and hidden aces. He was pulling her strings, making her his creature. The daughter of Walter Gerard was a fancy prize for a man like Mick. She pulled herself out of bed, stepped across icy floorboards in her pantalettes and chemise. She dug quickly, silently, through the heap of her clothing, the fringed mantlet, the jacket, the great sagging cage of her crinoline skirt, the jingling white cuirass of her corset.
"Get back in bed," Mick said lazily. "Don't get your monkey up. 'Tis cold out there."
He shook his head.
"'Tis not like you think, Sybil."
She refused to look at him, struggling into her corset by the window where frost-caked glass cut the upwashed glare of gaslight from the street. She cinched the corset's laces tight across her back with a quick, practiced snap of her wrists.
"Or if it is," Mick mused, watching her, "'tis only in small degree."
Across the street, the opera had let out. Gentry in their cloaks and top hats. Cab horses, their backs in blankets, stamped and shivered on the black macadam. White traces of clean suburban snow still clung to the gleaming coachwork of some lordship's steam gurney. Tarts were working the crowd, poor wretched souls. Hard indeed to find a kind face amid those goffered shirts and diamond studs on such a cold night. Sybil turned toward Mick, confused, angry and very much afraid.
"Who did you tell about me?"
"Not a living soul," Mick said. "Not even my friend the General. And I won't be peaching on you. Nobody's ever said Mick Radley's indiscreet. So get back in bed."
"I shan't," Sybil said,
standing straight, her bare feet freezing on the floorboards.
"Sybil Jones may share your bed, but the daughter of Walter Gerard is a personage of substance."
Mick blinked at her, surprised. He thought it over, rubbing his narrow chin, then nodded.
"'Tis my sad loss, then, Miss Gerard."
He sat up in bed and pointed at the door, with a dramatic sweep of his arm. "Put on your skirt, then, and your brass-heeled dolly boots, Miss Gerard, and out the door with you and your substance.
But 'twould be a great shame if you left. I've uses for a clever girl."
"I should say you do, you blackguard,"
said Sybil, but she hesitated. He had another card to play. She could sense it in the set of his face. He grinned at her, his eyes slitted.
"Have you ever been to Paris, Sybil?"
"Paris?"
Her breath clouded in mid-air.
"Yes," he said.
"The gay and the glamorous. Next destination for the General when his London lecture tour is done." Dandy Mick plucked at his lace cuffs. "What those uses are that I mentioned, I shan't as yet say. But the General is a man of deep stratagem, and the government of France have certain difficulties that require the help of experts." He leered triumphantly.
"But I can see that I bore you, eh?"
Sybil shifted from foot to foot.
"You'll take me to Paris, Mick," she said slowly. "And that's the true bill? No snicky humbugging?
Strictly square and level. If you don't believe me, I've a ticket in my coat for the Dover ferry."
Sybil walked to the brocade armchair in the corner and tugged at Mick's greatcoat. She shivered uncontrollably and slipped the greatcoat on. Fine, dark wool, like being wrapped in warm money.
"Try the right front pocket," Mick told her. "The card case."
He was amused and confident, as if it were funny that she didn't trust him. Sybil thrust her chilled hands into both pockets. Deep, plush-lined. Her left hand gripped a lump of hard, cold metal. She drew out a nasty little pepper-box derringer, ivory handle, intricate gleam of steel hammers and brass cartridges, small as her hand, but heavy.
"Naughty," said Mick, frowning. "Put it back, there's a girl."
Sybil put the thing away, gently but quickly, as if it were a live crab. In the other pocket she found his card case, red morocco leather. Inside were business cards, carte de visite with his engine-stippled portrait, a London train timetable, and an engraved slip of stiff, creamy parchment, first-class passage on the Newcomen out of Dover.
"You'll need two tickets, then," she hesitated, "if you really mean to take me."
Mick nodded, conceding the point.
"And another for the train from Cherbourg, too. And nothing simpler. I can wire for tickets downstairs at the lobby desk."
Sybil shivered again and wrapped the coat closer. Mick laughed at her.
"Don't give me that vinegar fizz. You're still thinking like a dolly mop."
"Stop it,"
Start thinking flash, or you'll be of no use to me. You're Mick's gal now, a high flyer.
She spoke slowly, reluctantly. I've never been with any man who knew I was Sybil Gerard.
That was a lie, of course. There was Egremont, the man who had ruined her. Charles Egremont had known very well who she was. But Egremont no longer mattered. He lived in a different world now, with his po-faced, respectable wife and his respectable children and his respectable seat in Parliament. And Sybil hadn't been dolly-mopping with Egremont. Not exactly, anyway. A matter of degree. She could tell that Mick was pleased at the lie she'd told him. It had flattered him. Mick opened a gleaming cigar case, extracted a cheroot, and lit it in the oily flare of a repeating match, filling the room with the candied smell of cherry tobacco.
"So now you feel a bit shy with me, do you?" he said at last. "Well, I prefer it that way. What I know, that gives me a bit more grip on you, don't it, than mere tin?"
His eyes narrowed. "It's what a cove knows that counts, ain't it, Sybil? More than land or money, more than birth. Information. Very flash." Sybil felt a moment of hatred for him, for his ease and confidence. Pure resentment, sharp and primal, but she crushed her feelings down. The hatred wavered, losing its purity, turning to shame. She did hate him, but only because he truly knew her. He knew how far Sybil Gerard had fallen, that she had been an educated girl with airs and graces, as good as any gentry girl once. From the days of her father's fame, from her girlhood, Sybil could remember Mick Radley's like. She knew the kind of boy that he had been. Ragged, angry factory boys, penny a score, who would crowd her father after his torchlight speeches and do whatever he commanded. Rip up railroad tracks, kick the boiler plugs out of spinning jennies, lay policemen's helmets by his feet. She and her father had fled from town to town, often by night, living in cellars, attics, anonymous rooms to let, hiding from the rad police and the daggers of other conspirators. And sometimes, when his own wild speeches had filled him with a burning elation, her father would embrace her and soberly promise her the world. She would live like gentry in a green and quiet England when King Steam was wrecked, when Byron and his industrial radicals were utterly destroyed. But a hempen rope had choked her father into silence. The radicals ruled on and on, moving from triumph to triumph, shuffling the world like a deck of cards. And now Mick Radley was up in the world, and Sybil Gerard was down. She stood there silently, wrapped in Mick's coat. Paris. The promise tempted her, and when she let herself believe him, there was a thrill behind it like lightning. She forced herself to think about leaving her life in London. It was a bad, a low, a sordid life, she knew, but not entirely desperate. She still had things to lose. Her rented room in Whitechapel, and dear Toby, her cat. There was Mrs. Winterhalter, who arranged meetings between fast girls and political gentlemen. Mrs. Winterhalter was a bored, but ladylike and steady, and her sort was difficult to find. And she would lose her two steady gentlemen, Mr. Chadwick and Mr. Kingsley, who each saw her twice a month. Steady tin, that was, and kept her from the street. But Chadwick had a jealous wife in Fulham, and in a moment of foolishness Sybil had stolen Kingsley's best cufflinks. She knew that he suspected. And neither man was half so free with his money as Dandy Mick. She forced herself to smile at him as sweetly as she could.
"You're a rum'un, Mick Radley. You know you've got my leading strings. Perhaps I was vexed with you at first, but I'm not so cakey as to not know a rum gentleman when I see one."
Mick blew smoke.
"You are a clever one," he said admiringly. "You talk blarney like an angel. You're not fooling me, though, so you needn't deceive yourself. Still, you're just the gal I need. Get back in bed."
She did as he told her.
"Jove," he said, "your blessed feet are two lumps of ice. Why don't you wear little slippers, eh?"
He tugged at her corset with determination.
"Slippers and black silk stockings," he said. "A gal looks very flash in bed with black silk stockings."